going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive, up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
That's right, Capital. It is the Going Deep podcast, and I am Donovan Bennett, although I don't sound like myself because I left it all on the field. I left my voice covering the Olympics, but it was a treat. But we're going to give you a bit of an Olympic recap on this episode, but it's not going to be the lame Olympic recaps you normally get from normal shows where we ask stupid questions like, what was your favorite medal? We're going to get into the nitty-gritty, the nuance of the games, and there's no better person to do that with than someone who was boots on the ground, venue to venue in the City of Light. That is Arash Madani, who joins me now. And Arash, I'm just going to rhyme off things I'm curious about based off your experience. And the first one is, how did you decide where to go? I know we know the schedule of events and we know who is projected to medal, and you can somewhat chart what movements might look like over the course of 2.5 weeks, but then the games happen, the stories happen. In this case, the stories happen before the games happen. How did you and your small but mighty crew decipher where you needed to be when throughout? What did that look like?
Yeah, well, let me first say about the crew. It was small and it was mighty. It was myself and Hugo Reichenbach, the maestro behind the camera, who was camera operator, logistics coordinator, translator, psychiatrist, cold beer procurer, and all the rest. It was just an amazing teammate to work with. But we went in with a plan that worked, honestly, Donovan, for 3 days. And then came a bunch of drones. And then came a real, like, you thought you knew how good Summer McIntosh was going to be, and then she took it to another level. And so you stuck a little bit to the plan. Like, we wanted to make sure we got into Lille one day for the basketball preliminaries. But then all of a sudden, the next thing you knew, once the soccer team beat France, we were booking a flight to Nice to get down to the south of France for that final prelim game. We were out of nowhere following a boxer from rural Nova Scotia who got into the semis and won the first medal in boxing for Canada in 28 years. We were back to Marseille for some more soccer. And then sometimes you get lucky. The day of the beach volleyball gold medal game, we were headed there. And then I'm like, you know what? We went to Liverpool, Nova Scotia. We told Sarah Mitten's story. Let's see this through. Let's go to the track. It's not like the 4x1 team's going to do anything. None of them even got to a final in the 100 or 200. But, like, let's finish this Sarah Mitten story. And Mitten ends up out in three throws, and the 4x1 team out of nowhere wins the relay for the first time in 28 years. So there's some luck involved. There's some making sure you're following everything going on and being flexible enough to be able to pivot where you need to.
So back here, to start the games, there was a conversation around the Canada soccer story on whether or not it should be as big of a story, whether or not the Canadian media was blowing it out of proportion, whether the repercussions on the team were harsher because the Canadian media was freaking out about it.
First, let me just stop you there. That's complete utter nonsense. FIFA is not reacting to the Canadian media.
No?
Let's just come on.
You don't think they're watching Serena Med's tweets and Sid Sixero's breakfast television rants?
You know, yeah. When you think about how FIFA operates, as popular a global icon as Sid Sixero is, I'm not quite sure that moves the needle in Switzerland.
What was the feeling on the ground in terms of how big of a story it was, because my answer was always, listen, you go on these news hits that I was doing, you get three topics in. One is going to be that topic because it changed literally every day. So by default, it is overshadowing something a Canadian athlete is doing. But there in the Olympic Village at the venues, how big of a story was it? How much oxygen out of the room did it take up?
Well, I would say that leading up to the opening ceremony, because the story broke on, Wednesday, I think, and the opening ceremony was Friday, those 48 hours, it was the number one story of the entire Olympics. Let's just take Canada out of the mix. Let's take soccer out of the mix. Let's take Olympics out of the mix. In the lead up to Malcolm Butler intercepting that ball against Seattle, for 12 days leading into the game, it probably didn't go away until the Thursday or Friday before the Super Bowl. Deflategate was it. Think about this. Like, this is a Belichick. Think of it through the Belichick lens. Think of it through the Brady lens. And now add the Olympics to it, because it's not that they were just allegedly cheating during the Olympics. These idiots were so stupid that at an event that spends multiple billions of dollars in security, specifically says do not use drones, and drones are one of the biggest fears of terrorism, these dudes still did it. How moronic are you? And how clueless to the world must you be if you continue your alleged standard operating procedure under this kind of backdrop? And so, of course, before an event has even started, as everybody's coming in, everyone's like, what the hell is going on with these Canadians? Because really, in the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, there was nothing else going on other than people arriving and needing to talk about something.
Yeah, I thought the reaction and the despicable, frankly, reaction at members of the media who were talking about and breaking news on the story was maybe not surprising, because, you know, the X app is where all morals go to die, but still surprising, considering, you know, some people wanted to have the moral high ground in the conversation. When, for you, did the story change? Because to me, people felt differently when central defenders started scoring goals and keeping this team alive. And the country here made a distinction from, we could be mad at the coaches and apathetic with the federation, but we can also support the players.
Yeah, well, it's not like there was a start and a stop to this. Because remember, like, first the story breaks and they try and scapegoat two assistant coaches. Then the next day, the head coach is full of bleep in an interview, and that's the next saga to the story. Then comes the head of the Canadian Olympic Committee saying, we believe the coach when she says she didn't know anything about this. So that became legs to the story. Then came Westhead's report that this has been going on for a while. And subsequently, at 2 a.m. in France, they send out a press release saying, we're sending the head coach home now. Then the next day is the opening press conference for the Canadian Olympic Committee, which is the day of the opening ceremony, and they have to answer it then. And when I talked to Janine Becky about it, she said, here we are in Saint-Étienne, nowhere near Paris, and it felt like every day things were getting worse and worse, and our situation's getting more and more buried. And then a day or two after that is when the 6 points were stripped, and a day or two after that is when the appeal was filed, and a day or two after that is when the appeal was denied. So I don't think it was until after they beat France to have 6 points through two matches, going into a do-or-die third match where they control their own destiny. And Vanessa Gilles came out and said, we're not cheaters. We're damn good we're damn good players and we're a damn good team. And we haven't eaten and we haven't slept, but this is the resilience. I think that's when the narrative changed, that the players are overcoming their coaching, they're overcoming their federation, they're overcoming all of it. I think it took a while before that happened, because every day felt more and more like a doomsday scenario until they beat France.
They were the defending Olympic gold medalists, and thus some people thought, okay, maybe they could get into the medals, even though the World Cup would have shown you otherwise.
Was it a disaster last summer? Yeah.
Yeah. Although they had much better form coming in, but still, it's a much different tournament. I think there were much higher expectations on Canada basketball in terms of getting a medal, if not medals, plural. You were around that group quite a bit a year ago and some this year. Frame for me how you assess what happened to the program in three different distinct ways.
I'll do it in two different distinct ways, because I don't know anything about three-on-three, I'll be honest with you. You know, I think the fact that they lost in the semifinals at the buzzer is disappointing, heartbreaking, all those things. They didn't medal. Okay, but I think there's three-on-three is on kind of one side of the equation, and traditional basketball is on another. I don't know, Donovan, what's rotten in the water with our national women's basketball program. Came up short in Rio, disastrous in Tokyo, and even worse this time around. Like, I think, if memory serves, they scored 2 points in a quarter against France.
Correct.
They've changed the coach, they've given them more resources, blah, blah, blah. I hate making analogies to hockey, and I especially have disdain towards the Maple Leafs when it comes to comparing anything there. But I almost feel like the Canadian national women's basketball team, when it comes to talent evaluation, is like the Leafs. We're just overvaluing them because of the uniform in which they're wearing. They showed up to a knife fight with a spoon, man. And that was the reality. And I'm not one to criticize amateur athletes much, but there are a bunch of pros on that team, and there are a bunch of pros on the men's team. All pros on the men's team. And the men just simply no-showed against France in the first half. And you can talk about officiating all you want, and you can do whatever, say whatever you will, but putting up 10 points in the first quarter, starting the game 3 of 15 on triples, missing critical free throws down the stretch that had nothing to do with the whistles, that had nothing to do with the crowd. They weren't ready for prime time, and it was an embarrassment. And they spent a lot of time talking about wanting to win gold. And I think of all the things, in all the areas where you can point at that Canada came up short in this entire Olympics, that men's basketball loss to me is number one on the poor showing, especially in the first half, that doomed them. Because I know France got the gold medal game. Canada should have been in there. And they did it to themselves.
I'm actually pretty bullish about the men's team moving forward. The result, although not ideal, didn't upset me for a couple of reasons. One, France was a couple bad calls away from not even making it to the knockout round.
Yep.
So they had a difficult group that they had to navigate almost perfectly, and they had a tough opponent and, as you mentioned, a bad half. But also, their second best player, like on pedigree, I suppose, not in performance, was clearly not himself. For whatever reason, Jamal Murray was not Jamal Murray. Never really integrated himself and never really had a relationship with SGA on the court. Didn't start, wasn't with the team in the lead-up, and was struggling to get by people that he wouldn't even think about when he's right, and by the end, wasn't even looking at the basket.
Yep.
And so I'm reticent to criticize him, because I'm also aware that we've had in this country, conversation about people pulling out at the last minute and finding reasons not to play. So if anyone is putting their hand up to put the jersey on, and that means that they're going to be vulnerable and not compromised, I can't bring myself to crush them when they don't meet the moment. I see.
But like, he didn't show up last summer. He didn't come to Europe with the team when everybody else did. It just seems like on something like this, when it's 6 weeks, you either have to be all in or not.
But the program
bent over backwards to accommodate every single thing that he wanted. And how did he reciprocate them on the floor after?
But he's clearly not healthy, though, right? Like,
I don't know. I don't know about that. I really don't.
Well, the eye test to me tells me that's not bubble
was
Jamal
he,
Murray.
Was he not healthy against the Lakers in the playoffs? Was he not healthy against Minnesota?
Probably not. And I think if you're the Denver Nuggets and their fans, you're worried that you're coming up to a contract extension conversation with a player who ended a year compromised and is going into one compromised. And I don't want to put this bad juju out there, but I'm watching him and I'm thinking, is this Brandon Roy? Is this Derrick Rose? Is this a player who early in his career showed us flashes and signs, had some compounding leg injuries, and then never was able to sustain that level?
Yeah, I don't see it that way. I saw it as somebody who wasn't all in. SGA was all in. Lou Dort was all in. Andrew Nembhard was all in. Dylan Brooks was all in. I just never got the sense. And he may not be 100%, but to me, that wasn't just a health thing. And then here's the other thing, Donovan. The whispers that I heard afterwards is that his agent was, I don't know if whining is the right word, whining to Canada Basketball about how he was used and questioning the coach's decisions on what was going on. Blah, 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 blah.
Well, I mean, on that front, the eye in the sky doesn't lie. You, based off of, I mean, he shot in the teens from three. Like, based on on the numbers, there was no real compelling case that he should have played any more than he did. In fact, you can make the case that he should have played less, especially in high leverage situations. I'm just looking forward to 2027, 2028, and you add a Ben Mathurin to this group, and you add a Shaedon Sharpe to this group. You potentially add a Ryan Nembhard to this group and a Zach Edey to this group. I just think the arrow is pointing up. Now, that's true for France. Like, there are players coming, plural, for France. So I don't think this equation gets any easier. But I think there were 5-6 teams who all went into this tournament expecting to get a medal. And musical chairs tells you that they all can't.
Yeah, of course. Of course. But from a talent standpoint, like, when you looked at, because Canada went 3-0, I look at what their road was in the knockout stage. France and then Germany, and then that gets you into the final. They were avoiding Serbia, and they were avoiding the United States. Canada was a better team than France, and they were a better team than Germany. And they fully underperformed. And they were garbage in the first half. They did it to themselves.
But were they a better team than France?
Yes.
France took a Steph Curry flurry for 3 minutes. Otherwise, France has a gold medal around their neck.
Yeah, but if ands and buts were candies and nuts, what a Merry Christmas it would be. You know, it's the FIBA game. It's a different deal. Like, coming into that game, it was all about, what are they going to do against Wemby? How are they going to guard Wemby? Wemby wasn't the issue at all. They shut Wembanyama down completely. Like, who is the best player in this entire Olympic tournament? Coming into this Olympic tournament, if you're going to say, I want one guy on my team to lead this team to a medal, if there's one player you're going to pick, let's say outside Steph Curry. I don't think anyone knew what Steph was going to be because he hadn't played FIBA in forever. It'd be Shea. It would have to be Shea. who showed up for Canada in that game? Where did they get anything from? Jordy, in like the first 8 minutes, had played 10 guys. He was looking for any kind of anything. It wasn't because of France that Canada scored 10 in the first quarter or 50 through three. France did not contest three-point shots to the extent where they missed 12 of their first 15. France wasn't responsible for missing critical free throws down the stretch.
Fair. We'll have to agree to disagree.
Yeah, fair.
When we look at the balance of the games, the thing that jumped out to me was the diversity of the medals. I know we were going to celebrate the medal count, but I think it's worth celebrating where the medals came from, because for a long time in our country, our medals came from water. In a pool, a body of water, or frozen water. And now we got fencing medals, taekwondo medals, weightlifting medals. When you look at how Canada accumulated their medals, what sticks out to you?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. First ever judo gold, first ever fencing medal, Eleanor Harvey winning it. Wyatt Sanford is from a village of fewer than 500 people, winning Canada's first boxing medal in 28 years. I'd say, all of those things. The diversity of the medals is a good one. And I don't want to beat a dead horse on this, but I think it needs to be said. It is a disgrace how our athletes are funded. There was a medalist who in 2023 received $24,000 in funding. And $13,000 of those dollars were spent on travel to different competitions to prepare for the Olympics. Eleanor Harvey, who won said fencing medal, top three in the world, told Heather Hiscox in an interview at Canada Olympic House with the medal around her neck that fencing is an expensive sport and the equipment is really pricey. And it got to the point where my mother sold our house. We moved into our grandmother's apartment. My grandmother slept on the couch so I could have a bed. So it's great that our athletes are overcoming their coaches and their federations and the system in which they have to operate in. And this, honestly, Donovan, this is why I take bigger issue with what happened with the basketball team than any amateur athlete, because think of everything provided for the basketball players, et cetera. I thought when the rowing eights won their silver medal, the leader of that group said, Canada, you should be proud of these women and buy them a candy bar because they can't afford one. There was a lot of truth to that statement. And as a country, don't we owe it to these people, to these athletes who lay it on the line, who represent the best of us, to at least give them a chance so that grandma doesn't have to sleep on the couch? Don't we at least owe them that?
I fundamentally agree with you, but for the sake of this conversation, I will provide the devil's advocate that I know some of our listeners probably feel, because it's a long-standing sentiment in this country, and it's that it's not a priority. That we live in a country with a real deficit, with real issues, where we would like our tax dollars to go to social services and paved roads. And if you would like to be a high-performance athlete, there is money to be made in the corporate sector.
Because I'd love to have that conversation with somebody, because there just isn't. And corporate Canada has really come up short in supporting our athletes. There is, and I want to be clear with this, there is next to no money for the majority of the athletes out there. There are, at best, of the 338 athletes who represented Canada on this contingent, at best, two dozen getting a little help from others.
Well, I think there's money. I think all the money goes to the same athletes. They all go to the same athletes.
There isn't much. I'm here to tell you that outside of maybe 20. People are like, most athletes are losing money. And those who are getting a little bit of corporate funding, they're barely making enough.
But this sounds like an economics problem, right? If I'm running a corporation, a for-profit business with shareholders, and I'm deciding where I'm going to use my marketing dollars, if you're not providing me, in my assessment, return on investment, am I just going to philanthropically give this money away so that you can have a more comfortable life in your dream to be an Olympian? Like, I agree, but I don't know what the easy solve is.
Yeah, if the money was going towards roads and healthcare, I'd agree with you, except the average wait time for a hospital is 9.5 hours in our beloved province, so I don't know where the money's going, to be honest.
If Arash Madani approves that message, he will be running for public office.
That's right.
Yeah, so
first I'm going to run for CFL commissioner, Donovan, because,
you already have enough bosses. You don't want to have nine. So
there you go.
Lastly, I will ask you the cheesy question before we let you go, and on a positive note. You really, really, really love covering the games. There are not many things you will sentimentally post about. Every 2 years, I know the Olympics will be one. What's the moment for you? I'm sure every games there is some lasting moment. For me, it might be Alicia Newman twerking. But for you, what is that moment that you're going to reflect back to the Paris games? And when Uncle Madani is telling stories to, Dwayne Ford's great-grandkids in 35 years, what are you going to tell him about the Paris games?
There's probably not one. There's a few. One was that a 17-year-old swimmer, her lead was so big in the 400 IM, coming home with a 5-second cushion, she actually broke into a smile under the water. How about that, Summer McIntosh? I'll tell him about Wyatt Sanford's community. Like, his village has a population of 473, but they came from all over in Hance County to Findlay Park, where they had a makeshift stage, and somebody put up a screen, and 1,000 people showed up to watch his fights, and he's going to bring home a bronze medal. I'll probably tell him about Jerome Blake, 898 on the backstretch, and Andre DeGrasse, 889 in the anchor leg. Because I can't remember a more important Olympic moment to me personally since the 4x1 in Atlanta gold. And I didn't think those jokers had a chance to finish top five, let alone win the sucker. And Andre on a bad hamstring was just something else. And they wanted to do it together. This is their last one together. It's dudes who like each other. It was Aaron Brown giving them an impassioned speech. They nearly had a bobble on the exchange from Brown to Blake, and it didn't matter. They did it. And so I think those are among the moments that really really stood out, because that 4x1 was just like, it's the closest thing to do you believe in miracles? Yes.
At some point we'll get you to do a dissertation on why Americans can't pass a baton around a track efficiently.
I should say. No, I disagree. Just keep doing it. Just keep screwing up. To hell with y'all. Who?
Well, my moment was watching Noah Lyles be wheeled off the courts. Only to see 48 hours later, he'd be in a club in France. Partying. But, listen, COVID's not real, so whatever. Your work ethic is, sir. I will tell my grandkids that you can use a suitcase as a standing desk. when you're
that's
on the
right.
road. So that's what right. Rash Madani does. Thank you, pal. Congrats on a great job.
All right, man. Appreciate it.
That was Rash Madani. You can give him a follow on social at Rash Madani, ArashMadani. We'll take a quick break right now. I will give this terrible voice a reprieve. And then Sho will come in and save me and give me his perspective on the Olympics. Stay with us.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson is a Sho.
And I'm so happy that you're listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had a Sho. Thank you.
That's right, it is the Going Deep podcast. I am Donovan Bennett. Thank you so much, Grandma and Granddad, as I bring in Sho. So, Sho, just tell me all the ways that Arash was just wrong. Just counter all of his points. Give me the cross-examination. In all seriousness, as I ended the conversation with Arash with a joke, my lasting moment of the games would be that 4x1. No one made a final. First time in Andre's career, he didn't make a final. First time in Andre's career, he didn't medal, never mind, in the Olympics. Didn't know if Andre was going to be able to make it to the end of the games with his bad hamstring and the news swirling around that his coach lost accreditation because of some safe sport allegations, which we didn't even get to get into with Arash. But I loved the symmetry of them doing it together. Been together for 3 games over a decade, and now they've got the entire Olympic medal pack, the capsule collection, bronze, silver, now gold. And I loved it with the symmetry of 96. Where for me, that was my favorite Olympic moment prior. A lot of people say Donovan winning and setting a record in 96. For me, it was that second Saturday night. Don Whitman had the amazing call, Canadians, you gotta love Saturday nights in Georgia. Because it wasn't an outlier. It wasn't just one guy. We had 4 guys who were faster than your best 4. All first generation Canadians, immigrants, all representing Canada proudly. And then fast forward to 2024. Once again, we got 4 guys. Not as good individually in these games, but better collectively. And once again, the children of immigrants. So I just thought that symmetry was really cool. What was the moment that stuck out to you?
Well, certainly I was pleased that the Canadian men's team won the 4x100 relay gold for a number of reasons, just because certainly one, gold is fun, but or any medal is fun. But two, I was a little afraid that the going deep curse of guests was going to like get Andre de Grasse permanently after he didn't qualify for the 100 and 200 meters.
although Phil Wizard.
This is true.
He pulled out a gold for us.
He did. I got to say, I think of, like, in terms of joyful moments at the Olympics, certainly watching, from an unexpected standpoint, watching Andre de Grasse cross the finish line, that was really cool in the 4x100 meter relay. And I think watching Phil Wizard going up against the French B-boy breaker was really fun as well, because they seemed like they were friends, like they seemed like, or at the very least, they were like respectful of one another. I mean, I'm sure they've crossed paths in like the circuit, for example. But I gotta say, they genuinely looked like they were having fun. And I think in the semis earlier that same day, like a couple, like an hour or so before or whatever, Phil Wizard, there was that moment where I guess he was against the Japanese B-boyer. He called his move. Right, he like at the end of the set, he like jumped on his head and put his legs in the air kind of thing. That was hilarious. Like the reaction was awesome as well from the commentary. I think that was one of my favorite, maybe because it was towards the end of the games and there are other things that happened, but that might have been one of my favorite moments in the games because it's a historic medal. It's kind of crazy, but you already know that breaking will not be at the Los Angeles Games in 2028. So he's going to be the reigning gold medalist for like at least 8 years, I guess, depending on how long it takes to get it back to the next set of Olympics. So I don't know. I find that really interesting. for a number of reasons, but I think the Phil Wizard medal, the Andre DeGrasse medal, and there are a couple other ones, like the ones where you either win or lose by 1/100th of a second were thrilling to watch as well, like Summer McIntosh overtaking the American at the finish line, or Katie Vincent on the speed canoe pursuit for the women's, winning by 1/100th, or Marco Arop losing, you don't say losing, but like he almost pulled ahead, won the silver medal, and the difference between a gold and silver was 1/100th. It just, the margins for error are absolutely bananas.
The Marco Arop one was tough because, yeah, you know, he kicks and pushes late and he just ran out of real estate. It's almost like he was trying to kiss the finish line. Yeah. If you look at the photo finish, trying to get there as fast as possible. I think you're always happy to win a medal, but silver is a weird one because in bronze, you generally won something. You beat someone out into the medals. You got yourself on the podium. Silver, you lost something. You lost gold. Like, sure, you won silver, but you were that close to gold. And so, aside from finishing fourth, filthy fourth, as Maggie McNeil called it, another podcast guest that didn't get a medal. the silver one is a weird one. When you look at Brandi Wilkerson and Melissa Humana Paredes, they got a silver, and surely they celebrated afterwards, but their Olympic experience ended in a loss. And we have talked to them individually in the past, so we got in the medals a little bit. But apologies to Damian Warner.
I felt bad for him. I felt really bad for him.
I was devastated, honestly, for Damian. I still am. He was so prepared and ready and was in the fight, and to go out that way, and to hear him apologize essentially to the country, as many Canadians who lost did, a very Canadian thing to do, was just devastating, especially because, you know, in that sport, it's a young man's game. You don't know necessarily what is promised in the future, if he'll be around until LA. He's said he's going to take it year by year and will be around for at least the World Championships next year, but you want that Olympic experience to end on a high. So I felt for Damian, and it could be the parents in me, but I felt for people who lost empathetically more than I was excited for the people that went. Sarah Mitten, who was the betting favorite, went into the final round clear favorite, and again in similar fashion to Damian, doesn't get it done. I felt bad for her. When you look at that, you talk about the men's basketball team. As much as we got a non-boycotted record in terms of medals, we left some meat on the bone in terms of medals that we thought we were going to get that we didn't get. Mohamed in two different distances.
Sure, yeah.
Agonizing fourth in a race he ran brilliantly, one of the fastest races of all time, and then is tripped up in a race that he was a favorite in. I feel for Mo as well.
Yeah, I think you look at a lot of the results for a lot of these athletes. And, I mean, to use the Damian Warner press conference as an example, I mean, you said he apologized, and he did it. Just, I remember watching it that morning and thinking to myself, I don't really know if he needs to apologize.
Definitely not.
You know what I mean? Like, this guy, for so many people, is viewed as, like, one of the most talented living Canadian athletes, essentially. I still think winning the gold in the decathlon of the previous Summer Games is one of the most impressive things I've ever seen, because you're essentially working in, like, eight events, right, or whatever it is. So I think a lot of Canadians felt similarly that he didn't, you know, he certainly is a hyper-competitive athlete, as a lot of these guys are, but he didn't really necessarily, you know, need to apologize, because I don't think anyone would say he let them down. It's an incredible feat to even be at the Olympics. I wanted to actually follow up a little bit on your conversation with Arash. You guys got fired up, Donovan, about the Canadian men's basketball team and the what went down. You know, I kind of agree with Arash that France was not a better team than Canada. Like, I think ultimately, if you're breaking down the talent level on all of these teams at the United States, Canada is the next most talented team, I would say, but that doesn't necessarily mean they played like it. Like, they played poorly, and I saw a lot of people blaming the refs against France, and as the knockout stage began, and yeah, I mean, like, the refs weren't great, certainly, but they also kind of did it to themselves a little bit, right? Like, you must have known going into the game against France that when you're playing the host country of the Olympics, they're probably going to get a little bit of the benefit of the doubt on calls. And again, they did, but I feel like Canada put themselves in a position where, like, 50-50 calls that might have gone France's way largely did. And, I mean, they didn't really help themselves out in that respect.
France shot 42 free throws. France shot the most free throws in a game since the U.S. in 2016, and that was essentially U.S. against Serbia, where they couldn't be stopped without fouling them. The refs were atrocious, and it's not just that they were bad. They were inconsistently bad.
Right.
Where you had no idea from play to play what was going to be a foul, what wasn't. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander got two hands shoved in the middle of the paint on defense, and there was no call, and it turned into a layup because of it. The refs were terrible. But yeah, Canada had more NBA talent, but this is not an NBA tournament. I just watched the Redeem Team documentary on Netflix.
That's a good documentary. Night.
It's very good. And what you forget about that team was they were going shot for shot with Spain in the gold medal game. Spain was led by the Gasol brothers, yes. The next best players on that team were Rudy Fernandez and Jose Calderon. On the Redeem team, Kobe Bryant, LeBron James, Carmelo Anthony, Dwayne Wade, Chris Bosh, Chris Paul, in form, Darren Williams. Like, this team, outside of the current USA team and the Dream Team, was the best basketball team ever assembled. It's in that conversation. My point is, in FIBA, talent only takes you so far. The American team that, again, needed Steph Curry to go Steph Curry in order to win, had one player that's not an all-star. That's Derek White. Essentially, it was just all-stars. And
there was a point, actually, in that game where the lineup on the floor had four MVPs on it, essentially.
Wild. And again, they were pushed by France. So if we're going to say, well, Canada, you had 10 NBA players, you should have beat France. Well, the Dream Team, this incarnation of it, had 10 all-stars. you should have killed France. I just don't think that correlates because the game is literally different. On top of the fact that, from a continuity standpoint, you're playing against a team that in many cases has played together for years.
So here's my question to you, Donovan. You might be more uniquely qualified to answer this. Is that then the fact that France did not have that many NBA players and Canada did? Is that because of the continuity in the FIBA game that they have experienced for many years? Or is that a mix of, like, a coaching failure by Jordy Fernandez to not prepare them adequately for that moment? Because they did look very prepared when they went perfect through their group stage, I would say.
And they were very prepared in the World Cup for the most part. I just think when the margins are slim at the elite competition, there are going to be things that are less intuitive because you haven't done it for your entire life. The FIBA ball has twice as many panels as the NBA ball. That is a tangible difference. The ability to knock the ball off the rim, you can tell someone that's a rule, but unless you've had the muscle memory of doing that for your entire life, it's going to be counterintuitive. The fact that in FIBA, when someone is cutting, you can move in front of them and block their path, and that's not a foul. That is the exact opposite of the freedom of movement you have in the NBA. So I just think these things do matter, and it's tough to correlate when you look on the floor and you're like, well, that one dude is better than that dude, and that dude's better than that dude. If the team with the better dude should win. And, like, I guess to a certain extent that's true, but it's not. And I would also say, and I tell people all the time about this in the CFL, there are players in the CFL who are much better than players in the NFL. The NFL is obviously the best game and the best league, but it doesn't have the best players. It has the combination of best players based off of age and injury and situation and size. But there are, you know, if you just had to play one game, there are players in the CFL that right now are better than players in the NFL and vice versa. And there are players playing in Europe who are better than players playing in the NBA. Did they get that opportunity? Is there a role or fit? Does the slot matter based off of where someone was drafted? Like, all of that stuff comes into play. But just because guys don't play on league pass doesn't mean they can't play at a high level in a condensed tournament.
I will say I do. It does make me want to watch the dunk by the French player on LeBron in the gold medal game. Did make me want to see what he'd get, what kind of look he would get if he did play in the NBA. I mean, that was one ridiculous dunk. This got up, just laid one on LeBron's head. I don't know if you saw some of the hilarious clips that were circulating afterwards, because people, I think, posted every possible imaginable angle of LeBron getting dunked on. And I mean, whatever, he won a gold medal. I'm sure he doesn't care that much, but I did see a lot of chatter that LeBron's going to have this clip deleted off the internet by Sunday, which actually did make me chuckle. But my question to you, Donovan, as we wrap up here, we got a couple minutes left here, but I look forward to the next Olympics, the Summer Games, actually the Winter Olympics, really, because we're going to get NHL players back at the Olympics, which I have said for a long number of years now that I would kill for, and we're actually going to get it. So thankfully for that, it's going to happen. But at the 2028 Games, probably for Team USA, you are not going to see LeBron and Curry, almost assuredly. I guess he could see Curry, depending on what he chooses and injury-wise and how his game ages, and it feels like his game probably will age pretty well, all things considered. But there's a real possibility that Team USA does not feature all of LeBron, Curry, and KD, potentially, in 2028, which is 4 years away. So I wonder, as you talk about the gap closing internationally, and gosh, the gap on the women's side for a USA team that has won like eight straight gold medals. They won by 1 point, and that game would have probably gone to overtime if Gabby Williams' foot wasn't on the three-point line. Her toe was on the three-point line, which is incredible shot-making and theatrics from her down the stretch. But, you know, the gap is now closed internationally, I think, in a lot of respects. Serbia will probably be better. France will probably be better. Spain is usually always decent, and they did not have a good showing. They'll probably be better. You expect Canada will be better as well. But I mean, if the top end talent, in terms of guys who are literally have their bust at Springfield made already for LeBron, KD, and Curry, I mean, I wonder what Team USA will look like, you know, if like the big dogs in the team are like Jason Tatum and Anthony Edwards and, I don't know, Devin Booker and whoever.
I would love for Curry to have one last dance, retire after the Olympics. Just that's the last time he plays basketball. Kevin Durant has already said don't rule him out. He has always, no matter who else has signed up, has said, I'm happy to play for my country. I mean, I think you're looking at a Chet Holmgren, Jalen Brunson led team by that point. But I think France is the country that scares me. They've got 3 years in a row picks in the top five. They had three picks in the top 10 this year. They could, it looks like Flag will go one, but they could potentially have another number one overall pick next year. France is the country that scares me. And it's interesting, I was thinking about this watching. Historically, people said, oh, the European game is so skilled and, you know, the Americans are so athletic. When you look at the game now, somewhat flipped. The Americans won that game off of their shooting. The teams like France with players like Wemby are super athletic and bouncy and have a great size-to-skill ratio. So it's funny how these things flip. My last question to you before we go, I have two. These are the questions that were in my Olympic group chat.
Okay.
Number one, is breaking a sport? Should it be in the Olympics?
You know what? I say yes. I say yes. It's a sport. I think, I mean, like the Olympics, I think we forget that not that long ago, I mean, maybe not in the last like 10 to 12 years, but not that long ago, like, I don't want to call it arts and crafts, but like there were other expressions of medal worthy events at the Olympics that included like painting and music and so on. Right. And I think that's, I mean, and I know now the Olympics has become a lot more about physical activity and sport and so on, which I think is at the core of its existence. But if that is a part of something that we've seen at the Olympics, there's no reason why breaking can't be. It is unfortunate that when you look back on the breaking tournament, you're not going to look back on what we talked about between Canada and France with Phil Wizard winning the gold. What you're going to look back on is a ray gun. And believe me, I have seen every possible meme that has existed from her doing like the T-Rex dance and like mopping the floor and stuff. Like it's kind of unfortunate because that's going to be the lasting memory of the sport at the Olympics. And it's not going to be like the actual medal winners.
Yeah. There's some reports online that ray gun got there suspiciously, like, lobbied and disqualified other contenders and essentially didn't qualify, which if you saw ray gun dance, that makes sense. Breaking is a sport. It is gymnastics with a better beat. It is figure skating on the ground. If other things that are done in gym class and at recess, like table tennis, are Olympic sports, skateboarding is an Olympic sport, breaking is definitely an Olympic sport. Shame on you, LA. I know we want baseball and softball back. Should not be at the expense of breaking. Lastly, before we go, should the Canadian women's national soccer team from Tokyo lose their medals?
No chance. There's no way. And I'm not saying that just because I'm a homer. I just think they got punished for the tournament they were in, and I was very impressed by the fact that they got out of the group stage in the first place. But you were talking about this with the rash. I think the ire was correctly blamed at the Federation and Beth Priestman and these two staffers, and probably should not be directed at the players themselves. And, you know, I mean, I think you have to go, I think it's up to each individual person to believe the players when you hear Stephanie LeBay or Christine Sinclair go out there, Diana Matheson, all of whom have been on Going Deep, go out there and talk to the media and say, we've never benefited from this. We've never experienced this. We've never seen like drone footage or whatever. And, you know, I think again, it's up to each person to whether or not you believe them. I personally do. And I think they got the correct punishment because I do agree with Arash. It's so incredibly stupid to go into France, a country that has very, very strict anti-terrorism laws that focus specifically on drones, and like fly a drone at practice, right? Even if you do believe that all teams use drones at different stages of their, or have or will or whatever, at different stages of their preparation for games, like no one else is doing it in France because they're not dumb enough to get away with it, think they can get away with it. So I think the punishment was apt. And I think the next stage that I guess hasn't actually happened yet will be to fire Beth Priestman from Canada Soccer. And I mean, that's like, it's a done deal pretty much. It hasn't actually happened, but there's no way that's not going to happen in the next, like, probably couple weeks or whatever.
Has to. When it does, we will be here to cover it. In the meantime, we will have more great conversations with athletes, many of which female athletes, just like the Rolodex that show just described. So make sure you continue to listen and subscribe. Thank you so much for listening. Talk to you soon.